Okay, so this is the title, and let me start with some definitions. So, what is a W star correspondence? A W star correspondence E over a von Neumann algebra M is, first of all, it's a right sister module, right Hilbert module over M, and that means it has an M-valued inner product with the usual properties of M of this M-valued inner product. Also, it is self-dual. That means it has sort of Ries theorem, meaning that every module map from E to M bounded and every bounded module map from E to M is really, you can get it by taking inner product with a fixed element of E. So this is what it means by self-dual. And it is also, so far it is just a right module over M, but you also make it into a left module by a normal star homomorphism, phi, going from M to L of E. L of E here means the algebra of a jointable module maps on E, bounded module maps on E, and it is known that with these properties, with the self-duality, the L of E becomes a von Neumann algebra, and so this makes sense, a normal star homomorphism from M into this von Neumann algebra, and this is giving you the left action. So now it is a bimodule with an inner product. So this is a W star correspondence, and they will be the stars of the show. Okay, now once you have something like this, you can form the so-called Fock space. Now the Fock space is really another W star correspondence over the same algebra, and you simply sum up M, E, E tensor with itself, E tensor with itself three times, etc. Each of them is a W star correspondence. You sum it up the way you usually sum up sister modules, and what you get is another W star correspondence over M. So it's a bimodule over M, and in fact, the left action is now given by this map, which I called here phi infinity. It takes a typical element in the Fock space. So a typical element is one element, a generic element here. So it's something like C1 tensor through CK. And the way you multiply on the left is simply you multiply on the left the C1. So this gives you an operator on the Fock space. So for every A in M, you get an operator like this, giving you the left action. Now, there's another, like the usual thing on Fock spaces, you also have the creation operators. So given xi in E, t sub xi will denote the creation operator, and you see the definition here. So it really takes an element in the k-tensor product of E, so E tensor with itself k times, into an element in the k plus 1 tensor product. So it's sort of a shift. Shifts you from M to E, from E to E square, from E square to E cube, and so on. Okay, now we have now this family of operators and this family of operators, and if you now consider the Banach algebra generated by these two families of operators, then this is called the tensor algebra, and it's a non-self-adjoint, non-self-adjoint algebra. And I'll denote by H infinity E, it's sigma weak closure. Again, these are all operators on L of the Fock space. L of the Fock space is a von Neumann algebra, and so when I say sigma weak closure, it's clear what I mean. So these are really the object of the study here, the H infinity E. Let me put it aside, and we'll see some examples. Excuse me? Yeah. It acts on the on C1. But let's okay. Here are some examples. So first, if you let M equals C, the complex numbers, and E is also C, then the Fock space is just C plus C plus C, which you can identify with H2 of the circle, and the tick C, the creation operator, is just the shift, and this phi infinity A is complex number, so it's just multiples of the identity. So when you take the algebra generated by this and take the sigma weak closure, this is the H infinity, the classical H infinity of the circle. So this is the what I refer to as the classical example. Now, if you take again M to be C, but this time E is an n-dimensional Hilbert space, so Cn, then what you get for H infinity, well, the Fock space is the Fock space of Hilbert spaces, and it was already mentioned in one of these of the talks here. And when you take creation operators, what you get is the algebra that was denoted by Ln by Davidson-Pitts, and was also studied by Popescu. So this is another example. Here's another one. If you let alpha be an endomorphism of the algebra, of the von Neumann algebra M, by E, I wrote E equals M sub alpha on the left, and what it means is, it's a bimodule. The right action is simply by multiplication. First, as a set, as a space, it is simply M. Now, the right action is by multiplication. The left action is by twisted multiplication. So A acts on the left by simply multiplying by alpha of A. So this is the bimodule actions, and the inner product you see here. The inner product of A and B is A star B. Then the H infinity, E becomes what I'll call the non-self-adjoint cross product. It is the sigma weak closure of algebras that were studied, for instance, by Justin Peters as the non-self-adjoint cross product. And here you simply take the sigma weak closure of this. Okay, so this is, and here's another example. If you take M to be the n by n diagonal matrices, which I wrote as Dn, and E are all the matrices, n by n matrices, which have non-zero entries only in the diagonal, the first diagonal over the main diagonal, then H infinity of E, well, the Fock space is simply the upper triangular matrices viewed as a Hilbert space with the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, but the H infinity E is simply the upper triangular or isomorphic to the upper triangular matrices. And similarly, you can write every nest algebra that has a finite nest as H infinity E. So this class contains every nest algebra with finite nest. And the algebra, the M, is simply the diagonal, and every such nest algebra you can write as a block upper triangular, and the E is really composed of the blocks that are above the main diagonal. Also, the algebras that were mentioned by Steve Powler, the free semigroupoids, are also examples of these this construction. There are also H infinity E for some E, which I will not describe, but coming from the graph that he was talking about. Okay, so these are some of the examples. And now I want to study representations of these. So first of all, the point is that a representation of H infinity comes from a representation of E. And what do I mean by a representation of E? So a representation of E, or more precisely, a completely contractive covariant representation of E, is a pair, T sigma, such that sigma is a representation, norma star homomorphism, so usual representation of the von Neumann algebra M on this Hilbert space. And T, from E to B of H, is a linear, completely contractive map with this property, and this property simply says that that T is a bimodule map, because this is you have here C and you act on it on the left by A, on the right by B, and this is saying that the A and the B can be pulled out using the sigma. So this is a bimodule map. So basically a representation of E is a bimodule map, but you need this sigma to make this to make sense out of it. Okay? So this is the representation of E. Now, it turns out that every representation of E gives you a completely contractive representation of the tensor algebra. Recall the tensor algebras. The tensor algebra, maybe I'll put the first slide here. The tensor algebra is the Banach algebra generated by the creation operators and the operators of left multiplication, and you define this representation T, T cos sigma by sending each of these left multiplication operators to sigma A, and the creation operator T sub xi is sent into T of xi. And of course you have to show that this can be extended to a representation of the tensor algebra, and it can. So it gives you a representation of the tensor algebra, and the other way around. Every representation of the tensor algebra comes from a representation of E. So that's a complete description of the representation of the tensor algebra. Okay, now before I say something about the representation of H infinity, which is a sigma weak closure, let me mention the following, because that's an important tool when you deal with such representations. It's this map T tilde. What you do, so assume you are given such a representation, such a pair, T and sigma. First, you form a new Hilbert space, E tensor over sigma with H. Now, here I describe what it is. So you first take the algebraic tensor product. Then you define this inner product here. Here I defined it on singletons. So xi tensor H and xi1 tensor H1, the inner product is the inner product in H of H. And then here you take xi tensor with xi inner product c1, that's an element of M, because this is the M-valued inner product. So that's an element of M. You apply sigma to it, you get an operator on H, you apply to H1, you get a vector in H, and now you take this inner product. Now, of course, you may have elements that have norm zero, so you have to mod out by them, and then you have to complete the usual thing, and you get a Hilbert space. So I'll denote this Hilbert space by E tensor H, and I may omit the sigma like I do in the next line. But anyway, once you have this Hilbert space, you can define the map T, and recall, you have this representation, you can define T tilde from this new Hilbert space to the original one in this way. It takes a singleton C tensor H to T C applied to H. And it's pretty clear that you have all the information that you have in that there is in T sigma is already here. And in fact, you can see that because this map, this T here, was defined to be completely contractive, turns out that this map between the two Hilbert spaces is contractive. And this bimodule property gets translated into this intertwining property. You notice what happens here. You apply T tilde, so you go from here to here, then you have this representation of M on H. You also have this representation, this is the representation of M on this space. This is defined simply by applying phi of A to E and the identity to H. So T tilde intertwines the two representations. So if you start with a pair like this, you get a map T tilde. It has these two properties. But also the converse holds. If you have these two properties, from this space to this, the intertwining and this contraction property, then you get a representation of E and therefore a representation of the algebra, of the tensor algebra. Okay, but this gives you, so this is a short description of the representation theory of the tensor algebra, but not every representation of the tensor algebra extends to the representation of the H infinity, which is a sigma weak closure. Take the classical case. In the classical case, the tensor algebra is the disk algebra, and the H infinity is the H infinity. So not every representation of the disk algebra extends. For instance, take evaluation at a point on the circle, that does not extend to H infinity. If you take evaluation at a point inside the circle, that's fine. But on the circle, it's not. So I'll be dealing, in this talk, I'll be dealing only with representations that have norm less than one. Now, you can, and they, if you have, so if the representation, or rather the map T tilde has norm strictly less than one, then the representation you get extends from the tensor algebra to H infinity. Now that's not an if and only if condition, and we have other, we can describe larger classes of representations of H infinity of E, and do the same analysis that will now come for these, but I will not, for simplicity, I will stick with these representations. Okay, so, but each of these gives you a representation of H infinity E, and this is just a piece of notation, but it's also a point of view that will come clearer later. If you have an element of H infinity E, and you have a representation that is given by this map T tilde, I want to think of X as a function on the representation space and say that its value at T tilde is what the representation gives to X. So it's the value is, of course, an element in B of H. But I want to think of X as being a function on the representation space with values in B of H. Okay, now now fix E, a W star correspondence, and fix sigma, which is a normal star homomorphism of M into B of H, but this time one-to-one. So from now on, sigma will be fixed with these properties. Really, what I want to do is I want to think of sigma. I want to say that M is contained in B of H and just give a name or a notation for this inclusion map. So sigma is the inclusion map. So what I'm really saying is that M is now being represented on a Hilbert space. Okay, and then you form the following, which is really... You have to compare it to this property. Although here, over there, T tilde goes from E tensor H to H, and now I take all the maps that go from H to E tensor H, and they do the same intertwining property, except that it's written the other way because it's going the other way. But I don't take this restriction about the norm, because now I want to have a space, a linear space. And what I get is, for each of these T tilde, the star of T tilde would lie here. So these are really, if you want, these are the stars, the adjoints of the maps coming from representations. But what I get is more than just a space. What I get is actually a W star correspondence, this time not over M, but over M prime. M prime is a short notation for sigma M prime. So I'm thinking really of sigma being the identity. So this is a correspondence. Here I wrote how you define the left and right actions and the inner product. At any rate, you start with E, which was a W star correspondence over M, and now you got a W star correspondence over M prime. And we call this the sigma dual of E, because it depends on sigma. If you embed M in a different on a different Hilbert space or in a different way, you might get a different dual. But this is called the sigma dual of E. Okay, but if you like this game, then you can repeat it, because you got another sigma representation, M prime, you got another W star correspondence over M prime this time. M prime is also sitting in B of H, and I'll write sigma prime for this inclusion. And you can ask for the dual of this with respect to sigma prime. And it turns out that you simply get the same thing you started with. So this is really the duality property. You do it once, you do it again, and you end up where you started. Okay. Let me again go to some simple examples. So the first example, in the classical case, M is C, E is C, H is arbitrary, M prime becomes simply B of H, because M is simply the scalar product of the identity. And the dual is also B of H. Take another one. M is C, E this time is CN, and H is arbitrary. M prime again is B of H, but this time the dual is CN B of H. So that's a column of N copies of B of H. That's a second. Here's a third example. So again, recall, when you have alpha in the endomorphism, an endomorphism of M, you can form E, which is I defined it before, M sub alpha. It's a correspondence over M, and then E sigma becomes this intertwining space. All the maps on B of H that intertwine. Now I'm dropping sigma here. This is really sigma of A. So that intertwine sigma, or the identity, with alpha. And in fact, if M is B of H, this becomes a W star correspondence over M prime. Now, if M is B of H, M prime is just a scalar, then a W star correspondence over M prime is a Hilbert space. And it turns out that this space is quite important in the study of endomorphisms, or even something like this can be defined for completely positive maps, but I won't go into this. Okay. Now, I want to introduce a special kind of representation of H infinity. So given E, given sigma, we can form the Fock space tensor over sigma with H. I already explained how this is defined. So that's another Hilbert space. And on it, we can define the induced representation of H infinity E. And the induced representation is simply defined by, you take an element in H infinity E, it naturally, the way it was defined, it naturally acts on this component, and you let it, so you define it by this, simply acting on the left factor by X and leaving the other factor untouched. So that's the induced representation. And in fact, when we had Steve Powell talk, and they were really considering the algebra in its induced representation. Now, of course, so this is when you take E, but if you, instead of E, you now take the dual of E, is E upper sigma, then you get another, then you get also an induced representation on another Hilbert space corresponding to this one. And what's the connection between the two? And the connection is the following. So this theorem, point 9, there is a unitary operator from one Hilbert space that you get with the original E to the other Hilbert space that you get with the dual, such that it carries it carries the image of the induced representation of the dual to the commutant of the induced representation of the original one. So this identifies the commutant of the induced representation. And again, a result that Steve Powell was showing in his case is really a special case of this. This is identification of the commutant of the induced representation. It always comes from from the induced representation of the dual. And well, a simple corollary for this is that it has this double dual property, or double commutant, I guess, property. And that's something I just want to mention here. And let me put it. Okay, and now I want to come to, the title of the talk was Duality of Correspondences, and that I tried to explain what is the dual, and we saw this application for identifying the commutant of the induced representation, and now I want to go on to the Nevanlinna peak theorem, which is related, of course. But let me firstly recall what is the classical Nevanlinna peak theorem. So you are given, it's an interpolation result. You are given k points in the open unit ball of C, and you are given k points in C. Then the following are equivalent. What you are really doing is you are looking for conditions for one to hold. What is one? There is a function in H infinity of the circle with norm less or equal than one that takes Zi to Wi. So that's an interpolation result. When can you find such a function that takes these points, Z1 into W1, Z2 into W2, etc., and it has norm less or equal than one? And the answer is, it's equivalent to the positivity of the matrix that you write in this way. This is what I wrote inside, is simply the ijth entry of this matrix. And this matrix is positive if and only if you can find such an interpolating function. Okay, now, in a moment, in the next slide, I'll write our generalization of this, but the idea between the generalization is the following, that now in the context that we have this E, M, sigma, and H, as I described before, again, recall what I said before, that I want to view elements of H infinity E as functions on the representation space. So, for them, I want to ask this interpolation result. Given representations, eta 1, eta 2, eta stars, because you remember you have to take the star in order to define a representation. At any rate, given k representations, is there an element of H infinity E in the unit ball of H infinity E that with pre-described or pre-chosen values at these representations? And it turns out that we have a theorem, we have a result that looks somewhat like the classical, Nevanlinna peak theorem. And it goes like this. So you fix eta 1 into eta 1 through eta k in the dual, and recall each of these gives you a representation of the algebra H infinity. They all have norms strictly less than 1, and you also given B1 through BK and C1 through CK in B of H. Then the following are equivalent. There is an element X in H infinity E with norm less or equal than 1, and such that BI times X of evaluated at eta I star is CI. If you want to be so it looks more like the classical theorem, just think of the BIs being the identity. And then it's really evaluation of the evaluation at X at this point is CI. So what are the conditions for this? The conditions for this, necessary and sufficient, is that a certain map, a certain matrix should be positive, actually completely positive, and the matrix is a matrix of maps. Each of these maps is a map from M prime to B of H. And so when you take a K by K matrix of maps like this, it defines for you in a natural way a map from the K by K matrices over M prime to the K by K matrices over B of H, simply applying the IJ map to the IJ entries. And this interpolation result is if and only if this map that you get from the K by K to the K by K is completely positive. And the explanation for this notation, the G and the theta, G sub B1, B2 is a map that takes A into B1, A, B2 star. That's from BH to BH, B of H. And the theta, what you see here, the theta, theta of eta 1, eta 2, takes an element in M prime, which I call here S, into the inner product of eta 1, inner product with S eta 2. So that's another element of M prime. So it's from M prime to itself. So anyway, you get a map, you get a K by K matrix of maps, and this should be completely positive in order for this to hold. Now, notice the following. If we are in the case where M is B of H, then M prime is just a scalar, and then we have here a map, a map from the K by K matrices, just usual matrices, and for this we have the result of Choi that tells you when such a map is completely positive, and if you use this result, you get that in this special case, condition 2 becomes simpler and becomes you have here not a matrix of maps, but matrix not maps between von Neumann algebras, but a matrix of operators on Hilbert space. And this matrix should be positive in the usual sense. So this is the theorem, and now I want to show some applications. What happens when you take this theorem and you apply it to specific examples? So if you take the classical example, M and H and E are all equal just to the complex numbers, you get a classical Nevanlinna peak theorem. If you make it a bit more complicated and let H be arbitrary, then the dual becomes B of H, and if you simply plug in into the theorem, you get the following. You get the following theorem. Given K operators in B of H, in the open unit ball of B of H, and B1 through BK, C1 through CK, also in B of H, then the following are equivalent. There is a function, so one is there is a function in H infinity of the circle, the classical H infinity, with normless or equal to 1, such that bi times fti is c. Here by fti, I'm referring to the H infinity calculus applied to ti. Ti are elements, are operators with norm less than, strictly less than 1. You can apply the H infinity calculus to this. And you ask, when can you interpolate like this? And it turns out that it is if and only if this matrix of maps, which I wrote here explicitly, is completely positive. So that's what you get for this case. Okay? Maybe I will leave the other one on the board. Okay, now the next example is the following. You take now M to be B of H, E is also B of H, M prime now is C, is a multiples of the identity, and the dual is C. And then you get the following theorem. So the theorem now is you for every Z1 through ZK in the open unit ball of C, and B1 through BK, C1 through CK in B of H, the following are equivalent. There is a G, an element of H infinity T, the classical one, tensor with B of H, that has norm less or equal than 1, and satisfies this. So if you plug in ZI and multiply by BI, you get CI. This evaluation is referring to the fact that this G can be thought of as a function from the open unit, from the open disk to B of H. And so you can evaluate it at the point ZI and get an operator in B of H. So when can you do this? If and only if this matrix of operators is positive. The next one, another application, is if you take M to be B of H, E to be the column space CN BH, so N copies of BH arranged in a column, and then M prime is CI, and the dual is CN, and then you get the theorem that was proved by Davidson Pitts and Arias and Popescu. And it's the following. Given eta 1 through eta k in the open unit ball of Cn and operator C1 through Ck in B of H, then the following are equivalent. There is an element in BH tensor Ln. Ln, I recall, is the notation for this free semigroup algebra. So you have an element in the in this tensor product with norm less or equal than 1, such that when you apply to this element the representations coming from the eta I, you get the CI, the pre-chosen CI. So when can you do this? If and only if this matrix of operators is positive. And this was proved by Davidson Pitts and also Arias and Popescu. We can get also from our theorem the following moreover, which was proved by Popescu later. And this is that if you choose the CI, these operators in B of H, but if you choose them to be in a sub-von Neumann algebra of B of H, then you can choose the Y here to be in N tensor Ln, not just BH tensor Ln. So this is another application of this theorem. And I told you that finite nest algebras are also of the form H infinity E, and indeed you can get interpolation results for nest algebras coming out of this theorem. And in fact, not only for finite nest algebras, but general nest algebras, but this is a standard, these are standard arguments to go from finiteness to generalness, was done by Arvidsson in the distance formula theorem and other people. So when you do this, you get the following two results, and they are known, and the people responsible for them are listed here, at least as far as I know. And the two theorems are, first, if n is an s in B of H and you fix two operators in B of H, then what are the conditions for having an element in the nest algebra such that Bx is C? That's if and only for every projection in the nest, Cn C star is less or equal than Bn B star. And this, as far as I know, was proved by Anousis and Katsoulis Moore Trent. And there is an earlier related result by Boll and Gochberg. And then we have this, for vector interpolation, we have when can you find an element in alg n with norm less or equal than 1 that carries, when you are given k vectors and other set of k vectors, when can you carry ui to vi for every I, you have this condition. And this was proved for, at least for k equals 1, for by Chris Lenz in 69, and I believe in these two papers it was proved in general. So they all can be gotten from this theorem. Okay, let me say a few words about the proof of the result, and actually the proof of two implies one. Just to show what goes into the proof, I won't go into any computations. Okay, so we have we are assuming this condition two, and I'll show you when it, where it comes into the picture. But first, I'll assume the bi are I. Let's not worry about them, and we define the map li for every I between 1 and k, I define maps going from H to this induced space in the following way. It takes H into H plus eta I tensor H plus eta I tensor eta I tensor H, etc., etc. This is an element. Well, it's really 1 plus eta I tensor with itself and so on. That's an element in here, and you tensor it with H. So it's an element in this in this tensor product, this which is a Hilbert space. Okay, now just for simplicity, to make it shorter, I'll write tau for the induced representation. So the induced representation is a representation, is really when you allow an operator to act only on the left, and here it acts like identity. So now I define the space MI to be the following. It's the image of the induced representation of the left action maps times LIH, the image of the maps LI. So this is MI, and then you close it. That's a space, that's the image of MI, then you take the span of it, and you get N. Okay, now where does the condition 2 come into the picture? It comes into the picture at this point. It allows you, it needs some computation, of course, but it allows you to define a contraction R from M, from this space, to itself, satisfying this property. Now, what is this property? You see the elements of MI are really tau of something times LI of something. So you take tau of something times LI of something, and in between the LI and the something, you stick in CI star. That's how R is defined. And it's not so clear that this is a bounded, well-defined map, but this is precisely what condition two allows you to do. So you do this, and you have this map. Now you compute, and you get that this map, the adjoint of this map, R star, has this commutation property. Roughly speaking, it commutes with tau of x for every x in H infinity. Okay, now you have to use a commutant lifting theorem, which I don't describe, but but we proved this in a previous paper, and you can lift the adjoint, the adjoint of R, to Y on the on this space with normal equilibrium 1 that commutes with that's here. That is the in the commutant of the image of the induced representation. So we have this commutant lifting. Now we got an element in the commutant of the induced representation, and now we use the previous theorem that identified this commutant of the induced representation, and we get an X in H infinity of E such that it has this property, and the U is the U from this identification of the commutant, and this X does the job in 1. And of course you need computation, but I show this I'm skipping a lot of things here, but the main thing is that I wanted to show where condition 2 comes into play, and this is to allow for a definition of a certain map, and then you have commutant lifting and the identification of the commutant, and these are the main ingredients. And let me end up with another application of the theorem, and this time really, 2 implies 1. Not 1 implies, no, I'm sorry, 1 implies 2. And this is to prove a version of Schwarz's lemma. So this is what it is. So suppose you have X in H infinity of E with norm less or equal than 1. And like in the classical Schwarz lemma, I assume X at 0 is 0. Now let's understand what it means. X 0 is now referring to the 0 representation. Well, no, to the representation associated with eta equals 0. Now that's not the 0 representation. That just means that the component of the applied to the E or that just means that creation operators go into zero. But the left action operators, they don't go into zero. For them it is just sigma. So it's not the zero representation. It's the representation that is defined when you map creation operators to zero. So at any rate, if you have these conditions, then for every element in every representation like this, it's really a representation, you have the following. If A is an element of M prime, a positive element of M prime, and it satisfies what you see here, that inner product eta inner product with A eta is less or equal than A, then X evaluated at eta prime, eta star times A times the adjoint of X evaluated at eta star is less or equal than eta inner product with A eta. Now, to look more like the classical Schwarz lemma, take A equals the identity, and then this is what you get. Then this condition, holds, and then what you get is simply that X evaluated at this representation times the adjoint of it is less or equal than the inner product of eta with itself. And the proof is the same way you can do it in the classical case, and that's if I'm using here again 1 implies 2. So the proof of 1, you don't need to prove 2. 2 is just applying it to A equals the identity. You use the main theorem, theorem over there, with K equals 2, eta 1 equals 0, eta 2 equals eta, Bi is I, C1 is 0, and C2 is X evaluated at eta star. Okay, because you are given X this time. And then the condition that appears in 2 is the positivity of such a map, or complete positivity of such a matrix, where Psi is this map that I wrote here, and this map is completely positive. That implies that Psi minus the identity is completely positive, and you, when you apply it to this element, which was assumed to be positive, then you get the condition that appears here. So that concludes. Thank you very much.